I'd like to pull together several of the scriptures we've read during our time together. The truth is, Christmas is all about rescue. Christmas is God's greatest rescue mission ever, His most daring rescue mission. He became one of us, Jesus, the eternal Son of God, became one of us and took on everything that was ours and took responsibility for us, not just to forgive us, but to deliver us, to transform us, to give us the standard and the identity of righteousness so that we can stand not just forgiven, but embraced. And the message of this rescue is one of peace. Matter of fact, the two readings from the Old Testament and the New Testament record the word peace four different times. That rescue is a rescue to peace. Peace from God and peace with God. And yet the reality is, even as those who name the name of Christ, who live in union with Him, we often don't live with that experience of peace. It eludes us. And instead of peace, we know tension, anxiety, loss, grieving, uncertainty, disruption, loneliness. The list goes on. The question is why? Why is it that instead of the peace that we want to know that's promised to us, we know what people who don't know Jesus experience and find it so common in our lives? Why is it that, like the psalmist, we find ourselves asking the same question that's the most common question in the Psalms? Do you realize that no question appears more commonly in the book of Psalms than this? Two words. How long? How long, O Lord? How long does this have to stay this way? How long do I have to wait? How long before this changes? Lord, how long? 20 times it shows up in the Psalms, the hymn book of our faith. And there it is. Instead of peace, we find ourselves wondering, how will this peace-producing rescue become mine? How and how long will it take? I'd like us to think about some of what we've read and go back to our assurance of pardon. It's on the opposite page in Isaiah 61. Because those verses record the first sermon that Jesus ever preached. When He came to Galilee, after He was baptized and then was tempted in the wilderness for 40 days, returned to Galilee, the first time that Luke, this is Luke chapter 4, Jesus appears in the synagogue, the scroll of the prophet Isaiah is handed to Him. Jesus unrolls it and He begins reading. This is the text from which He reads. Isaiah 61. We'll read all the way through verse 7. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor, the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant to those who mourn in Zion, to give them a beautiful headdress instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the garment of praise instead of a spirit of heaviness, a faint spirit, that they may be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that He may be glorified. They shall build up the ancient ruins. They shall raise up the former devastations. They shall repair the ruined cities, the devastation of many generations. Strangers shall stand and tend your flocks. Foreigners shall be your plowmen and vine dressers. But you shall be called the priests of the Lord. They shall speak of you as the ministers of our God. You shall eat the wealth of the nations, and in their glory you shall boast. Instead of your shame, there shall be a double portion. Instead of dishonor, they shall rejoice in their lot. Therefore, in their land they shall possess a double portion. They shall have everlasting joy. I wonder if you heard it. In these brief verses, you find a series of exchanges. The language is very specific. Instead of this, you shall have this. Instead of this, you shall have this. Four of them, actually. I'd like to point them out to you very briefly, show you what they mean, and then show you why it's so important for us to celebrate that today as we come to the sacrament and as we begin a new year. Okay? So the exchanges are these. First of all, ashes for beauty. I used to sing a song in the church that I grew up. He gives us beauty for ashes, the oil of joy for mourning, the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness. You ever sing that song? Very simple chorus. I grew up in an old Christian and Missionary Alliance church. We sang that a lot. The first exchange, ashes for beauty. Ashes are a picture of loss, a picture of grieving. It's what's left over when something of value is burned up. And God says, in exchange for your ashes, I offer you beauty. Not just the ashes are swept away, but real beauty in exchange for your ashes. Second exchange, grieving for joy. The way we respond to ashes is with grieving. The way we respond to beauty is with joy. And the greater the beauty, the deeper the joy. God says, I'm not just going to exchange the ashes for beauty, but I'm going to exchange the way you respond to your ashes and your beauty. I'm going to fill you with joy. And then he goes on to say, I'm going to exchange despair for praise, the garment of praise instead of a faint spirit. Some translations list it this way, it's a spirit of heaviness or a spirit of despair. Interesting, as we look at our ashes, what's lost, what no longer is, what was precious and it's gone, and then the grieving, and you track that forward into your future, if that's what you have, you know what fills your future? Heaviness and despair. A faint spirit. It's the how long? What's the use? God says, not only am I going to exchange your ashes for beauty, you're grieving for joy, but as you look forward, instead of your heaviness, your despair, I'm going to fill you and clothe you with a garment of praise. Not praise for yourself, but I'm going to put my praise in your lips so that when you look at the sweep of my providence, all that I've done, every place of brokenness, grieving, and loss, I'm going to fill your heart and your mouth with praise. You won't be able to contain it. You will look at me and say, that was hard, that was broken, that was messed up. God, I praise you. You have exchanged my ashes for beauty, my grieving for joy, and you filled my heart with praise for you. And then there's a fourth exchange that's the foundation for all of it. It's in verse 7, and it's staggering what God promises if you think about it. In verse 7, he says, instead of your shame, there shall be a double portion. Instead of dishonor, they shall rejoice in their lot. Therefore, in their land, they shall possess a double portion. They shall have everlasting joy. Now look, one of the things I've discovered as I deal with people is we struggle with guilt and we struggle with shame, but they're not the same. And shame in our culture is pervasive, more so now than I think I've ever before seen. Guilt says, I feel bad about what I've done. Shame says, I feel bad about who I am. Guilt deals with our performance. I did badly, performed badly. Shame says, who I am is unthinkable. Guilt says, I feel bad that I lied. I didn't tell the truth. Shame says, I cannot believe that I'm the kind of person who is so insecure that I have to lie to keep you thinking well of me. You see the difference? It goes to the core of our identity, that shame. And twice in this passage, it talks about shame exchanged for a double portion. You know what a double portion is? You go back to the Old Testament, the double portion was what was given to the firstborn, the favorite. When a man wanted to divide his property up between his children, everyone got one share except the firstborn. He got a double portion. It was a way of saying, you're my first, you're my best, you're my favorite. What God is saying is in exchange for your shame, I am offering you the status of being my favorite. Which is why the book of Hebrews says, you've not come to a mountain that rumbles and cannot be touched, the mountain of the law, but you have come to Mount Zion. You have come to the church of the firstborn. And that's plural. Meaning, if you belong to Jesus, if you're in union with Him, if you're part of His church, then you're part of the church of the firstborn ones. Practically, what that means is that when God looks at you through Jesus, He now not only sees a forgiven sinner, but the Father looks at you and He smiles and He says, you're my favorite. Instead of your shame, He smiles, wraps you up in His warm embrace and says, you are my favorite. God doesn't have any red-headed stepchildren who are accepted, but you know, you're on the periphery. You're either His very favorite or you don't yet belong to Him. And I don't make myself His favorite. It's all the exchange that He has promised to bring about. It's a magnificent exchange, isn't it? The question is, how does it happen? How does that exchange occur in my life when instead of feeling that reality, I still feel the disruption, the alienation, the distance, the longing, the how long, oh Lord, does it still have to go on this way? How does that exchange happen? Well, I had a great illustration for you, but it kind of falls flat when you realize that it's warmer here in Alaska than it is in my home in Mississippi this week. I was going to talk about the Latin home and how nice it is to wake up and it's cold outside, bitter cold, and it's warm. But Jason walked out the house in his shirt without a coat on. And I can't wear this heavy parka that I brought because I figured I'd need it. See, here's how it works. It worked this way in Romania when we lived there for the better part of a decade and had a house that was built like a Yeti cooler. And it had a sensor outside that the colder it got outside, the more this central heating centrale, as they called it, would hum on the inside. You could barely hear it. It was a real high efficiency furnace. But the colder it got outside, the more it would hum on the inside. And you knew it was cold outside, and you could feel that even in the house it's cold, but that centrale would pump hot water, scalding hot water, all through the walls of that house and the radiators. And progressively, the heat would overwhelm the coldness. It was never a point in time, now it's cold, now it's hot. It was just a progressive, overwhelming exchange. Tim Keller puts it this way. He describes it with these words. As sorrow comes into the heart of the Christian, it presses us further into Jesus, the furnace of our joy. And it gets us closer to Him. It helps us dig down deeper into Him. And the joy kicks up, you might say, like a furnace. And the joy overwhelms the sorrow. That's the picture of a solid Christian, not a sorrowless person who is happy all the time or doesn't show his grieving or who doesn't enter into the loss. No, a person who is a Christian has a furnace of joy within that kicks up as the sorrow comes in and the joy overwhelms the sorrow. I have a friend in Mobile, Alabama, who lives in a really broken neighborhood. He's a church planter in one of the worst, most violent neighborhoods in the Deep South. Lots of people get killed in his neighborhood. He's got 5 young children that he raises right in the middle. He's a white guy with a white wife and white kids, and everyone around him, African-American, and it is rough. And he is, just recently, 2 weeks ago, they buried another young woman. Regularly burying people with whom he has been living life, sharing Christ. But here's a statement he made that has just stuck with me. He says, I've learned that sorrow digs the hole that joy intends to fill. The deeper the hole, the greater the joy that God intends to fill us with. And the more we push away the sorrow, the more we refuse to enter into the lament or the grieving, the shallower will be the joy that we experience. You see, the true Christian enters into the grieving and embraces the grieving because the grieving presses us into Jesus. And the closer we draw near to Him, the closer, the dearer He becomes to us, the deeper the joy can become. That's what He intends. So the furnace illustration, overwhelming the heat, is a good one, but it breaks down. Because the truth is, some people know sorrow, and it doesn't press them into Jesus. It doesn't make joy deeper in their lives. It actually hardens and embitters them. So here's the question, what makes the difference? What makes the difference between a sorrow that comes in and softens one person and draws them nearer to Christ so that the joy becomes deeper and richer, and another person, same sorrow, and they become embittered and hardened? What makes the difference? I know this is going to sound like the Sunday school answer is, but the answer is Jesus. The answer is, how are you responding to Jesus? Not hunting the joy, not hunting the peace, not hunting the deliverance, saying, Jesus, please give me joy. Please take away the sorrow. That's not the goal. If that's what you're after, it will harden you. The question is, how is Jesus becoming more precious, more beautiful, more trustworthy to you because of the sorrow, because of the brokenness? And this is what Christmas is all about. When Jesus preached that first sermon in the synagogue in Galilee, when He pointed to this passage and He read it, Luke 4 says, Jesus finished reading that passage, then He rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down, which is where the rabbis would be when they taught. And it says, the eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on Him, and He began by saying to them, today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. Of course, we understand that they didn't get it. That was the beginning of His sermon. But what Jesus was saying is this, I am the fulfillment of this passage. I am the rescue. I am the exchange. And they nodded and said, wow, this man speaks so well. He speaks with authority. Listen to him. Where did he get all this? He didn't even go to college. Listen to him. But they didn't get it. Because what Jesus was telling them was what Isaiah prophesied 700 years earlier He was going to become. Think about it. The one who knew unmeasured beauty, the one who defined beauty itself, became our ashes. That's really what the incarnation is, right? The one who knew unmeasured, unbridled joy from all eternity past becomes our grieving, so much so that the Bible calls Him the man of sorrows. The one whom the angels celebrated with joy and brilliance and exuberance becomes the man of sorrow, becomes our grieving. The one who experienced uninterrupted praise and fullness for all eternity past now is rejected and is abandoned, filled with despair to the point of hanging on the cross saying, God, my God, why have you forsaken me? The one who knew the favor of the Father, the one, the only one who ever really deserved the true favor of the Father saying, you're my favorite, the delight of the Father, he hangs on a cross naked, becoming our shame. Everything that he promised, that Isaiah promised that God would exchange, Jesus first became. He became our ashes, he became our grieving, he became our despair, our abandonment. He became our shame, all so that he could, in exchange, offer us his beauty, his joy, his fullness, and the honor of being the favorite of the Father. See, Jesus had to become all of that first for us in order to offer us that in exchange. Point is this. As we look for this beauty and joy and delight of being favored by our Father, lives filled with praise for the one who calls us to himself, it's not looking for joy that is the answer. looking for Him. It's looking to draw near to the One who is our exchange, so that in our brokenness, in our grieving, it's not that He exchanges one thing for another, like I give someone at the store a dollar and they give me a can of Coke. It's not that point in time exchange. It starts there. That's what justification is. But for the rest of our time, our rest of our lives, until we see Jesus face to face, it's like that furnace. That the deeper the grieving, the deeper the brokenness, the more awful the shame, the more it presses us into Jesus, the more His joy, His beauty, His praise, His favor overwhelms the sorrow, the brokenness, the shame, emptiness, and the despair. And that's the rest of our lives. What makes the difference? Simple question is this. What are you being pressed toward? And how is your grieving, your brokenness, pressing you into Jesus, where He becomes the one you're looking for? Not the gifts that He gives us, but that He Himself becomes the one who withholds no good thing from us. What's our response? Our response is to say with the psalmist, with the prophet, all those who follow Jesus, turn to the rescuer and say, I have known so much ashes. I have known so much grieving, so much heaviness and shame. And yet I come to You just as I am. I lay hold of You, not to get something from for myself, but to get You for myself. You are the exchange. And as Jesus becomes precious, His beauty becomes ours. His joy becomes ours. His praise fills our lives. And His favor becomes our identity. That's what brings us to the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. Because here before us, we have that very reality presented to us. That's the beauty of the gospel. This is the Lord's table, which is for the Lord's people. And if you have made by faith that exchange, your sin for His righteousness, your ashes for His beauty, your grieving for His joy, your despair, your heaviness for praise of Jesus filling your life, your shame for His favor. If you have made that exchange, and if you are making that exchange, then this table is for you, and you're invited to come with joy.